Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, June 25th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Frederick Hoff, and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan.
So, let us begin with Iran and the looking at this, of course, over the weekend, and we continue to talk about this. But it's been nearly two decades since any country elbowed its way into the club of nuclear-armed nations. President Trump, with his bombing of three Iranian nuclear installations last weekend, has vowed to keep the door shut. Whether Mr. Trump's preemptive strike will succeed in doing that is hard to predict, so soon after the attack and the fragile ceasefire that has followed, but already it is stirring fears that Iran and other countries will draw a very different conclusion than the one the White House intended, that having a bomb is the only protection in a threatening world. The last country to get one, North Korea, has never faced such an attack, and years of defying demands to dismantle its nuclear program, it is now viewed as largely impregnable. Also, we look at what the president himself is saying. As the ceasefire between Israel and Iran entered a second day, President Trump pushed back on a preliminary classified U.S. intelligence report that suggested American strikes did not significantly set back Iran's nuclear ambitions. You will remember that on Saturday evening, when the president spoke to the nation, he said that the program had been, quote, obliterated. So we now look at this, and the president continues to say that there is far greater damage there. Where the president is saying that it has been put off for years, a report coming out and saying that it will be set back by only a few months. So let us begin with that bit of information, and we'll go to Ambassador Fred Hoff.
Well, Joe, I think one of the difficulties here, one of the things that causes some of the confusion about the state of things, is the fact that battle damage reports on this Fordo underground facility have been completely conflated with Iran's ability or inability to weaponize nuclear weapons. Nuclear energy. Even if it turns out that Fordo has been utterly, completely, totally obliterated, as the president says, it doesn't necessarily mean that Iran is unable to weaponize. I have a bit of personal, professional history with this. From 2013 to 2015, I was involved in Track 2 unofficial talks with former Iranian officials, with people very, very close to the regime in Tehran. Our mission was to see unofficially if there might be a basis for an official agreement between the United States and Iran on nuclear weapons. We went back and forth with the Iranians, and at one point, the head of the Iranian team turned to me, and he said, "Fred," he said, "you got to understand one thing. We have been able to work our will in the Middle East without nuclear weapons. Iranian power extends all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. We virtually run Lebanon and Iraq. The president of Syria is our client. We've done all of this without nuclear weapons." Okay. And the fact is, if we were to weaponize our nuclear energy, every other country in the region would do the same thing. And this is not in our interests to do it, to have the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Turks, everybody else with a nuclear weapon, because then every time we make a move in the region, we've got the equivalent of the Cuban Missile Crisis on our hands. And given what we've been able to accomplish without these weapons, we don't want them. So I asked, I said, okay, in that case, what are the negotiations about? Why are you negotiating with the Obama administration about a nuclear deal? Why not just invite the UN in to inspect everything? And he said, very frankly, we want to get out from under sanctions. So I think what Iran has been shooting for over the years has been to be in basically the same position that Japan is in right now. If Japan were to make a decision to develop nuclear weapons, it would be able to field those weapons in a matter of a few months. What may have changed over the last couple of months is the Iranian perception, with the near destruction of Hezbollah, with the fall of the Assad regime. Iran's perception might be, now we need nuclear weapons, because all of our other deterrent mechanisms have failed. They've been destroyed. So I would not be at all surprised to see that Israeli intelligence assessments about Iran actually being on the path to weaponization proved to be correct in all of this. But again, even if Fordo were removed from the surface of the earth, that doesn't necessarily mean that Iran no longer has that capability.
Fred Hoff. We go from Fred Hoff to Bob Griffin. You all got to start wearing name tags. Go ahead. Go, Bob.
At least you didn't call me Heather. So
Oh, Heather Mulligan's here, by the way, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
Really nice to have you here.
I'm sorry I'm late.
That's all right.
I grievously injured myself playing golf yesterday.
Ooh.
And everything is taking forever. It's not broken, but my thumb is like non-functional. You have no idea how important your thumb is, especially in your dominant hand.
You use it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's important. And I mean, the only plus like right now is you get to put some maybe ice on it and cool yourself down.
I had ice on it in the car, but it's already melted. It looks like a drumstick. It's like,
oh,
yeah.
Man.
How do you injure your thumb playing golf?
Oh, because I'm not a very good golfer, but literally my second shot of the night, and I hit the ground with so much force that it like twisted my thumb all the way around. And and I played the rest, and I actually got two pars after that, but I still had a terrible score. Oof. And it was hot. It was really hot.
Yeah,
so I was grumpy the whole time, too.
Well, glad you're here.
Thank you. Sorry. This is my therapy.
So we will we'll hear your thoughts on this in a second. Let's go to Bob Griffin.
So Fred, you make some really important observations. And, you know, I really have some significant concerns about what we actually achieved on Saturday night. And there's a certain feeling that I get about the attacks on Saturday that feels more like it was a wag the dog scenario. I think we're in a more tenuous position right now for what, you know, Fred just laid out, especially if the purpose now appears to be regime change and the regime feels like it is under threat, but also, looking what the Israelis were able to accomplish, the sense of security within Iran is that they don't have any deterrence anymore. That the missile program that they had put a lot of effort into, their air their air defense systems, which they put a lot of resources into, or their drone programs, which they put a ton of resources into, weren't working, then what is left for the regime? And then you're starting to look at weapons of mass destruction, and certainly the atomic nuclear pathway, I think, is something that is one of the few paths that they have left open to them. I also worry that part of the impetus of sanctions was to sort of try to curb the move towards the weaponization. You know, we were in conversations about, okay, what can we do to allow for nuclear power? Now that we've gotten militarily involved in this situation, I think it invites our adversaries in both Russia and China and North Korea to trade more openly and to provide resources that they may have been reluctant to provide, or technical expertise which they have been reluctant to provide. And when I look at the reports coming out about the damage assessment, if we only set their program back by several months versus years or decades, we actually may have strengthened the regime's control over their own people. And I think, you know, part of the hope was that if we could prove that the regime was unable to protect its people, that there would be some sort of popular uprising when the regime can actually hold up and say, listen, you know, we face the might of the largest military in the world, and look, we're still, you know, we may be bruised, but we're not defeated. I think that changes a lot of the equations. It also, I think, raises a lot of doubts in my mind about how tenable the ceasefire is, particularly if the Israelis are looking at this as a weakened adversary that they could further have significant military gains given their military, but also their intelligence gathering, which makes the whole situation even more tenuous. And I'll put it right out here, Joe. You know, this whole situation feels much more to me like a made for Nobel Peace Prize program than it did any significant military or diplomatic gain. Especially as we hear about the possible pre-warnings, and we hear about the missing 900 pounds of at least the 60% enriched materials. When we hear about the warnings that we received about the counterattacks on our own bases, this fish really smells.
All right, Heather.
Wow. I wish I didn't have the fish smells lingering.
The lead in of the fish smelling. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah,
that.
So I mean, I think my primary takeaway from this was, to me, I see this about basically three different global leaders, regimes. And the question that I have coming out of this, is it realistic that there could be regime change? Because I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know how empowered the Iranian people are. I have several friends who are Iranians who fled Iran, when the current regime came in. And I just don't know if the people there are empowered enough for that to be a real possibility. And that's just a knowledge gap that I have. I wish I knew. If I knew to a certainty that was a real possibility, then I would say that is the best path to ending, you know, nuclear escalation, right? But
well, Heather, your knowledge gap is shared by, anybody who knows what they're talking about with Iran will acknowledge that there's a knowledge gap as to what comes next. I mean, I sincerely hope that there is complete regime change.
Yes.
In Iran. Iran's leaders have plenty of American blood on their hands, including some personal friends of mine.
Yep.
From when I served in the military. But if regime change is going to take place, it's got to be a 100% Iranian undertaking.
Yep.
The more Americans speak about regime change, the more the regime itself says, please keep talking, keep talking.
Yep.
Same thing with Israelis. The more Israelis talk about Iranian regime change, the supreme leader is delighted to hear that kind of chatter because it does enable him to appeal to Iranian nationalism and in a sense, to strengthen the grip of this miserable, corrupt, incompetent, and murderous regime. So I hope it will eventually take place. It's going to take time, and it's going to have to be exclusively the work of Iranians to at last elevate leaders who are more interested in the welfare of the Iranian people than anything else.
Yeah, and so my follow-up thought on that is, if there is not regime change, I think what the degree of damage that we did to their nuclear capacity is kind of irrelevant, because whether it's 6 months or a year, it's just time. They would still come back, right? That's still be able to rebuild the program, and they've certainly got assistance from other corners of the world, and they've got financial resources. So, you know, if we're going to have a big debate about is it 6 months or is it, you know, 2 years, I guess there's a part of me that's like, who cares but for the time, right? I mean, it's really what needs to happen is in some way this has to shift the focus of the Iranian governance, right? Of what is their mission and purpose in life. And if it's to take care of Iranian people, great. That's what you want to see, right? You want to see a government focused on taking care of its own people and not trying to bring an end, you know, whether it's directly or by proxy, to governments or people in other parts of the world.
Well, and what's required now, I mean, whether we like it or not, these characters are still in charge.
Yes.
Even though the supreme leader is down in a bunker somewhere. What's required of the United States now, ideally in partnership with others, but unlikely to take place that way, is a sustained diplomatic effort. I guess, you know, contrary to the wishes of President Trump, will be a bit time-consuming. It will take time to come to an agreement with the Iranians about enrichment, about non-weaponization, and then monitoring. One of the remarkable things to many of us in this crisis has been the extent to which the Iranian governing class has been penetrated by Israeli intelligence, and the regime in Tehran is going to have to keep this in mind. If it comes to an agreement with the United States and decides then to play games with it, because I suspect that that Donald Trump, if double crossed, is not going to feel amused about things.
What is your take on? I mean, I actually thought it was positive that he reacted as strongly as he did to the continued, I guess, violation of the ceasefire agreement. But I was quite surprised, actually, at you know, he, you know, his chastising didn't, it wasn't limited to Iran. He very much went after.
His choice of language was a bit colorful.
Yeah, and setting that aside, which, you know, trust me, I say those words too much.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. But I just wonder, I mean, I thought that was somewhat positive that, you know, that there was a rebuke by President Trump in that moment.
But there's a certain irony to it, too, though, isn't there, that you know, we bombed them, you know, and then all of a sudden we're upset that there's not a ceasefire. And it's kind of hard to play the peacemaker after you just dropped you know, how many, you know, bombs on in a non-declared war. Couple observations too that you remember, you know, Fred, you know probably more than I do on this. We were involved in an overthrow that put the Shah in charge in Iran. So we were involved in regime change in Iran in the past. And again, it was the Shah that was overturned that brought us the theocracy. So we, you know, the death to America comes from a deep-seated distrust within the Iranian community of our involvement. I'll also note, and Heather, your comments about the program, I think, are really spot on. It's also ironic to me that at a time when the Trump administration basically says that they see very little value in research and development and in the sciences, the Israelis are prioritizing the targeting of Iranian scientists because they know what that means to the program.
Right, exactly.
And that the program isn't just the centrifuges, it's the people who actually can run them and create these weapons. And it's that intellectual class that they're going after, the very thing that this administration sees no value in here in our own country.
That was Robert Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, June 25th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, June 26, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College, and since 2023, she has been President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Rydell, and Mayor of the City of Albany, Kathy Sheehan.
Let's begin with this. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth opened a news conference Thursday at the Pentagon by attacking the media over reports questioning the extent of damage to Iranian nuclear sites by U.S. airstrikes early Sunday. This continued what we heard yesterday. If you were listening to this program yesterday, we included the President of the United States news conference from the NATO summit in the Netherlands, where he went after specifically CNN and New York Times for their coverage of the questioning of the extent of damage, and going so far as to say that that was maligning the troops who were responsible for dropping the bombs, and they were saying they were not doing their jobs. Hegseth said, because you cheer against President Donald Trump so hard, it's in your DNA and your blood because you want him not to be successful so bad. You have to cheer against the efficacy of these strikes. Hegseth said, ahead of comments by General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that included additional details on the planning and execution of the U.S. strikes. At the White House, the president, and you mentioned this, plans to hold an event later today to make the case for passage of his massive tax and immigration package as the Senate eyes a vote in the coming days, with July 4th being the deadline. General Kane told the news media there were early indications Iran was planning a retaliatory attack on Monday in Qatar, which forced commanders there to mostly empty the facility. Fewer than 50 U.S. troops remained to defend the base using two Patriot missile batteries, he said. We believe that this is the largest single Patriot engagement in U.S. military history. Malia.
It just strikes me that Pete Hegseth was acting more like a Fox News, not surprisingly, a Fox News commentator than a Secretary of Defense at this press conference, which I did not see. Apparently, it happened while I was driving up here. So I'm hearing this the same time as our radio listeners. But I also want to just share some insight into how what's called the battle damage assessment process typically works. The fact that some of this information was leaked a couple days ago, and then there's a different assessment coming out now. The leak, I'm very curious to see how this administration continues to maybe go after leakers or not. Were they behind the leak themselves? I mean, that's a whole political question, I think. But the fact that there are updates to the assessment coming out is not necessarily political. Because battle damage assessment is a process, and it's dependent on a whole series of intelligence tools that are not that you have to bring together, and a whole series of coordinations that have to be done that can be time consuming, and you don't have all the information immediately. So there's always some kind of initial assessment, and then as you get more details, an updated assessment is done. So that in itself is not different from what would typically happen. The fact that we sitting here in the civilians know about it, that's what's different. And some of the tools feeding into the battle damage assessment are probably Israeli intelligence. They have much better intelligence in Iran than any other country in the world. And they're not leaking their intelligence, but no doubt they're sharing some of it with us. And so that's a time-consuming process as well to get whatever their assessment is. And we may never know, and the intelligence community may never know the full extent of what exactly happened. We know some damage was done, and so there's always an element of informed speculation, let's say, about what the likelihood is of the degree of damage and how that impacts Iran's ability to continue building a nuclear bomb.
We just heard from the BBC at the bottom of the hour the report that from Iran that the U.S. did not really gain anything in this, and it was just, I believe the word they used was showmanship. How much can we that they led that they left with that story? I'm curious as to how seriously we can take that assessment.
Well, if you take sort of a longer view, this is it, in a larger sense. Yes, you could say there's some showmanship here. I mean, the whole reason that Iran was re-pursuing this nuclear weapons was because Trump tore up the agreement that had existed. And so the fact that now they restarted their program, let's make no mistake, this is a murderous regime in Iran that has financed terrorism in many regions of the world for a very long time and is responsible for the deaths of many, many people. There should be no qualms about anyone being against Iran getting a nuclear weapon, at least from the perspective of U.S. security, the security of our people overseas. I think there's a lot of bipartisan agreement on that, and there has been for many years. But how do you stop them from getting a weapon? The agreement that was in place appeared to have been working, but Trump didn't believe it, got rid of it, and now so they started pursuing nuclear weapons. And then so he, instead of trying to put an agreement in place again, he goes in and bombs them. Now, maybe that is what impelled them to come back to the table for a ceasefire. But it seems like the entire situation was unnecessary. And it probably wouldn't have happened if that agreement had remained in place.
But can I just ask a question? Is part of this, and I don't know because I haven't gone back and looked, but part of this is that Trump came out before the planes had even returned to their airbase and said that something along the lines of there's been a complete annihilation or whatever that was.
Right.
And so we have a president that, he got out over his skis on it, right? I mean, the president should have come out and said, we had a successful mission, they hit their targets, and they've returned home, right? And so now we're arguing about this. And it is frustrating because it's divisive. I don't want to talk about him. I want to talk about what you just talked about. I want to talk about policy. I want to talk about the future. I want to talk about what it means. Right. And so that is, I think you started this with saying that you were quoting, saying that like we hate Trump so much that we're just going to jump on everything. Well, you know what?
Quote.
I think Trump had a very successful NATO visit. Right. I think a strong NATO benefits all of us. And we might not like his tactics, but I think based on what the NATO leaders are saying, they feel as though they're building a stronger NATO. Right. So I do think, how do we get away from this polarizing personal attack? And
even a broken clock is right twice a day. So
right.
that's like
right.
it's yeah, I think the analysis has to.
Don't you wonder whether in the scripted remarks of the word obliterated was on the screen?
Does he read what's on the screen? I think.
Well,
that's
what I mean. I'm just wondering if the people who are preparing that would have put the word obliterated or that was added.
I don't think they would have had him talk as.
They may have known that's the kind of thing that he likes to say, and so they would have. I mean, it's like that. Everything he does is he just has such a political instinct, and so on this, on every other initiative that he has, he's going to say it's the biggest, best, most beautiful
right.
bill. It's
exactly.
It's we obliterated right. and so I think his that's part of what his supporters like about him. They like this aura that he tries to project of triumph and success, and they don't necessarily take him exactly literally. They're like, okay, it was good. Now we get the details about what actually happened, but generally they think. This was positive, and the fact that the CIA felt compelled to release another update to sort of correct the record is really unusual.
But this seems a little odd. I mean, clearly trying to create his own reality, right, by saying obliterated. And also saying there's a ceasefire when in fact maybe there hadn't been an agreed ceasefire because then there was silence for a long time, right? But the thing that I find fascinating, and this is probably too complex, but they could have succeeded in deeply destroying the Fordo site, right, and damaging the other two, and not have fully disrupted the Iranian program. Right? Both can be true. It can be true that they, and we don't know yet if they fully destroyed the Fordo site because, and this is what the IAEA and Bulletin Atomic Science is where I get my background to try to educate myself about this because I'm not in any way close to an expert. But one of the things that I read is it's so deep that even these it's not right.
Bunker busting
bombs. Thank you. Oh my gosh! As powerful as they are, it is so deep that it would take several of them and to have it work just right to fully destroy the facility. Now they did say today, General Kane did say that they were able to drop four of them on the site, so that was a big success. But you still don't know.
Yeah.
But even whether they did or not, that doesn't mean that they have dismantled. The capacity for Iran to create a nuclear weapon, right?
No, it did demonstrate the willingness to to take extraordinary action to prevent them from getting a weapon.
Right.
So that I think Iran's retaliation by firing missiles at the Al Udeid air base was also performative. They couldn't not take some action against the United States, but they clearly are concerned about self-preservation, and so they had to take some kind of retaliatory action. They told us they're going to, so we could prepare, we could evacuate the base, make sure that everything's ready, and worked very closely and well with it. I mean, this is actually a good example of our alliance with Qatar and how well that worked to protect the people of Qatar and the people at Al Udeid Air Base. So I think the Iranians are probably whether or not this particular strike ended or obliterated or whatever, their program, they are probably reassessing. And it may drive them to, I don't know to what extent they could be more secretive about it. Maybe they'll somehow become even more secretive, so it'll be harder to track. And so then it would be harder to strike in the future if some remnants of it remain. Or they could decide, we want to put a pause on this and see how we can get some gains out of this situation.
As we are discussing, there was a press conference this morning with Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, talking about the military action over the weekend and what has taken place over the past week. One other thing that I wanted to add to the discussion, we can certainly continue down the avenues that we have started to go down, but I wanted to add to this of the White House planning to limit classified intelligence sharing with Congress after leaks to the press of an early assessment undermined President Donald Trump's claim that U.S. airstrikes obliterated Iranian nuclear facilities. This will make this contentious just by its nature amid a political battle over what the intelligence shows. The White House is expected to send four of its top national security officials to brief lawmakers, Pete Hegseth, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, and General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, according to administration officials. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, who testified in March that U.S. intelligence agencies assessed that Iran was not building a nuclear weapon, will be notably absent. I think we are being struck in the studio, oddly enough. So this is... While there is an argument going on of whether this was done legally and Congress should have approved it, it seems odd that you would further limit information to Congress on what then happened.
Well, and Congress has an oversight responsibility.
Yes.
So I think there are legal reasons. That would be really interesting if members of Congress sued the administration for not to have their access to classified information limited. But they are required to have that information so they can perform their duties as our elected representatives. And Congress has been set up that way for a very long time. There are classified briefing rooms. The people who are on the House Armed Services Committee that's Senate Armed Services. But on these committees that oversee various parts of the defense establishment and national security establishment have not just themselves the right clearances, but they have staff who have clearances who specialize in these things, and that is their staff's portfolio. And so there's a whole apparatus set up to enable this relationship between Congress and the national security establishment to make sure that that the laws that Congress is passing and the money that it's appropriating is used in the way intended. And they can't do that if they don't have all the right access.
And they, am I right that they didn't, there's something called the Gang of Eight, which are the top Democrat and Republican on each of the core committees of jurisdiction. And in the past, they've always been notified in advance. And in this case, they only notified the Republicans and the Gang of Eight. They did not notify the Democrats, which is highly regular. So not only not sharing information, but not even notifying them.
Did they check their Slack apps? Maybe it was on there.
They said, and apparently they didn't reach Hakeem Jeffries either, which I don't know why that happened.
Not that this is surprising, and I don't pretend that I find this at all surprising, but the whole idea of why it's being limited is so that because Trump felt that he was undermined in this, that there was information that was leaked to the press that he didn't want leaked to the press.
And then somehow blaming that on Congress.
Yes, and there's no evidence that it had anything to do with congressional oversight that the information was leaked.
Not to mention CNN and New York Times, who got scolded yesterday for their actions for reporting the story about a report that came out guarding the assessment of the damage. Yeah.
I worry about not so much that, but the undermining of the intelligence system, of the cuts in staff, and the national security staff within the White House. He doesn't have a national security advisor. Well, on paper it's Rubio, but you can't be the Secretary of State and the national security advisor at the same time. They're different tasks. But also, they've reduced and want to reduce even further the number of people collecting intelligence, and also because, as you allude to, if you're not handling classified information in a proper way, then other countries are going to be more concerned about giving us intelligence. Is that based on your experience, Malia? Is that something we should be worried about?
I don't know enough about these proposed cuts, because the intelligence community has expanded a lot over the past 20 years, especially since 9/11, and not all of it. In fact, a large percentage of what I know of that, I mean, it's very shadowy, of course, is in the bureaucracy of it. This whole new bureaucracy was created, the Director of National Intelligence, to bring together a bunch of agencies to make sure there was better coordination, because one of the lessons learned from 9/11 is that some of these agencies weren't sharing with each other. And so the instinct to create another bureaucracy went into full gear. And so it's not necessarily going to I'm not sure, from where I sit, that bureaucracy has really been super effective in increasing the quality of American intelligence. It's hard to draw a direct line there. So if cuts are to some of that bureaucracy, I'm not sure what kind that may not be terrible. If it's to the collectors out there, then that's a whole different question. If it's in places where we have agreements with allies, we have a very strong what's called Four Eyes community, intelligence sharing agreements with Canada, the UK, and Australia, where we're able to cut back because they have a stronger presence or stronger knowledge in some area. That's not necessarily a bad thing as long as we're able to keep sharing with them. I think there's some questions The more we see leaks of intelligence in the United States press, the more some of our allies are going to be like, wait a minute, are we able to continue sharing?
That was Malia Dumont on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, June 26. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, June 27th, Joe was out and David Gastina hosted. He was joined by partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator Mark Grimm, and professor of economics at Siena College, Aaron Pasitti.
Here we are already discussing before on air. You know, we like to have conversations, and that's exactly what we're going to do with you right now, just after hearing the decision by the Supreme Court. Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm David Gastina. This is the Roundtable panel. We're here with Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator Mark Grimm, and Aaron Pasitti, professor of economics at Siena College. In fact, they're both Siena College guys, and then we have Sienna, which is spelled differently over here. Exactly. We already talked about
that. We'll still take her anyway.
All right.
And send your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Here it is from the Associated Press. You just heard it from NPR. We'll repeat it. So we set up the issue here. A divided Supreme Court has ruled that individual judges lack the authority to grant nationwide injunctions, but the decision leaves unclear the fate of President Donald Trump's restrictions on birthright citizenship. The outcome today was a victory for Trump, who has complained about individual judges throwing up obstacles to his agenda, but a conservative majority left open the possibility that the birthright citizenship changes could remain blocked nationwide. The Republican president's order would deny citizenship to U.S.-born children of people who are in the country illegally. Sienna, you started our conversation about this. Now we know what's happened. What do you make of it?
Oh, man, I'm not shocked. I am a bit disappointed. But nevertheless, it is what it is. So what we see happening here is basically the court saying that the judges did exceed their power. And so what they're narrowing the scope of the nationwide injunction power. And basically they're saying that judges have the right to, you know, issue injunctions for the plaintiffs in front of them. And then Justice Kavanaugh said in the concurrence that this does not include giving injunctive relief to class action lawsuits, right? So people in that class. And then they also, Kavanaugh also said, which I think is important, I was happy I saw that, is that they also are not limiting the injunction power when it comes to agency orders, the APA. So that's a big deal for us because, you know, when an agency issues something, and we need injunctive relief because the agency's order is federal, so it will go out throughout the whole country. So there's still a little bit of wiggle room, but we're seeing there's definitely some regulations about exceeding the power, exceeding the scope, which we have to remember will affect both parties at different times and different administrations. What does it mean for us today? It means in 28 states. In 30 days, this executive order will take effect. We don't know how. It's an executive order. This means in 30 days, they have to kind of promulgate some sort of regulations around it and what have you. I'm trying to figure out in my immigration brain, how does this work? Because according to the INA, Immigration and Nationality Act, minors under the age of 18 cannot naturalize. Naturalize is how one becomes a citizen, right? And so what happens... I'm just trying to figure out what this looks like in practice. But
you're not the only one.
And this means that individuals who are here on an H-1B visa, on a student visa, on a temporary work visa, if they have children here in the country, then their children will be dependents of their H-4 visa, which means dependents of their visa, which means that when the child turns 21, they will need their own visa status here in the U.S. That's what that means. So that means that the child starts going to college here, even before the child completes college, we have to figure out what kind of status they have because they can no longer be under the status of their parent, just logistically. And then obviously the first prong of the executive order is if you're here in the country and you are without status or undocumented, then that child would not have automatic citizenship. But then I think about all the implications. So if someone had temporary protected status and then it ended, were they a citizen because they were under temporary protected status or are they not a citizen? So there's so many wrinkles to this and it's so complex. And in 28 states, we're going to be dealing with that. So
does that include any states around here?
Oh, I didn't look at the 28. We'll find out.
What do you think, Aaron?
I wish Sarah Rogerson was here to help explain all of this, but anyway, she's not. So, as Sienna pointed out, you know, this decision cuts both ways. So it's important to remember that President Biden had at least four of his student loan forgiveness plans stopped by an injunction by a lower court judge. So this ruling would have enabled him to proceed with that and to implement that on a much larger scale instead of having it stopped nationwide at multiple junctures. So, you know, it's interesting to see how this is going to lead to, I mean, one, this is going to overwhelm the court system because you're going to have larger class mm-hmm. action suits and individuals filing on their own behalf in states that they know will be friendly. So I think this is going to create a lot of chaos within the court system, and I don't know how that plays out and how the courts are going to be able to handle this. But kind of taking a step back, since I'm not familiar with all of the legal details, is that, you know, the net effect of this, since it's really dealing with birthright citizenship, is to, you know, take the Stephen Miller Trump approach of instilling fear amongst people who are thinking about coming here or people who are thinking about staying here, and to at least, you know, whether it's, you know, it's not necessarily through outright deportations, but to slow the pace of immigration. And like I said at the beginning of this discussion, immigration is a small net positive for U.S. economic growth. By reducing the flow of immigrants, that's going to serve as a headwind to longer-term economic growth. Immigrants have a tendency to create more jobs. They have a tendency, relative to native-born workers, to create small businesses. So that's something that we're not going to see immediately, but that's something that's probably going to play out over decades if, and that's a big if, this whole immigration debate and the end of birthright citizenship stands.
Mark Grimm.
Well, I think this was all brought on because there were judges who were trying to advance a political policy rather than protect the Constitution. And our dilemma is, yes, a judge should absolutely protect the Constitution at every step. But I don't think that's what always has happened. It's just they don't like Trump and they're going to have their own political policy. But as Aaron said, there's going to be Democratic presidents. Mm-hmm. So this is going to apply to them, too. So this is really, and it's confusing, despite Sienna's great efforts to explain it. This is not settled, is the way I look at it. But I do think it sends a message to judges who believe they should set policy rather than the House, mm-hmm. the Senate, and the President of the United States.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking about judge shopping. What did you call it, judge?
Forum shopping.
Forum shopping. But part of this decision along party lines is because there's a Supreme Court that has been loaded in Trump's favor, isn't there?
But the liberals vote in lockstep too. So, and I don't know what Amy Coney Barrett. I don't know where she stands.
But the point was to get a majority on that Supreme Court to mm-hmm. prove all his policies. But they haven't done it universally.
But this ruling will apply to Democrat presidents.
Right. Sure.
Think about this. Here's an interesting counterfactual. Imagine it's 2021. And Biden was able to stack the Supreme Court with a 6-3 supermajority. And you have, you know, he's passing these student loan forgiveness programs. And lower court conservative judges are saying, nope, can't do this. Do you think the Supreme Court would have voted differently if it was stacked with, you know, 6-3 with Biden appointees?
We'll never know.
No, I know we won't, but I'm saying it's an interesting thought experiment.
I think they would have upheld the right to a nationwide injunction. I think that maybe they would have had that long-term look to say, like, this could impact both parties. Let's go back to the Obama administration. We had another immigration where the DREAM Act came up, but for parents, right? Parents who are here. And that was an executive order that Obama instituted, and that was stopped by an injunction nationwide. And it went all the way up to Supreme Court, and it was found to be like he exceeded his powers. But nevertheless, I mean, that's when he used an executive order against Obama, right? So it's not the first time this has come up in the immigration context. It actually comes mm-hmm. up quite frequently in the immigration context that we are up against injunctive relief. And it's just more difficult for us as a practice and as an agency when you have these injunctions in various jurisdictions, because the federal agency has to respond differently depending on where the person is applying from. So it's a lot more work for that federal agency to figure that out.
So can class action lawsuits span states, or are they specific to a state?
Usually we refer it to federal courts. It's states. It's okay. Because the state's going to sue the government, right? Because then that's the, exactly. On behalf of the states. Or it can be by district, right? Because they're set up by circuits and what have you. So
But you can have nationwide class action lawsuits. I'm guessing they're just much more difficult to
get your class
organize and
Is all this a sign to of the erosion of our confidence in the court system and judges?
I think so. Judges used to be, well, that's great.
Yeah.
In fact, the Supreme Court votes were like 90-6 or something like that. Those days are gone.
It seemed like the respect for the high court has really
diminished. Oh, yeah. Well, they really tear them apart. I don't know who would put their name up for a Supreme Court justice the way they try to destroy. It's personal destruction attempts. Kavanaugh is the classic case, I think. But, yeah, I think the courts have there's less confidence in the courts, and it's a shame. Because they really are the standard bearers for protecting individual rights through the via the Constitution, but in some cases that's not what they're doing.
Yeah, I agree with that. That there's this politicization of previously independent authorities like the Supreme Court, and as we were talking off air, the Federal Reserve. But what I don't understand, and this is kind of a much broader point, is that it's clear Trump wants to govern by executive order, but he's got a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate. This would be a lot more effective if that administration could hunker down and actually pass legislation when they control Congress and the White House. And instead, it's just these flurry of executive orders that go to a lower court, then they go to the Supreme Court. And there's all this ambiguity surrounding it of how it's going to work out. I mean, I think there's a personality issue into why he's choosing to do this. He wants to rule by fiat with the crown and the cape and the throne. But it just seems like I'm surprised that his more sensible advisors aren't saying draft a bill and get it through Congress, right?
Do we know that?
I don't.
It's not that easy, though. Anything. I mean, he doesn't control the House. They got the nutty caucus there that held up the speaker vote for 15 votes. I mean, so he really doesn't control the House. And he wants power. But hello, every president wants power,
sure.
And this tension between the executive order, which I want, and the other ways, that's going to persist no matter whether, Trump has the personality aspect to it. I get that. But the fact of the matter, all the presidents have wanted power, and Biden and Obama had a lot of executive orders. You're seeing more of it because there's more. It's very hard to get anything passed through Congress.
That's the big issue, isn't it?
Right.
And all Americans
recognize
it.
But it's America's fault. We're a 50-50 country.
Yeah.
And, the House and Senate reflect that in the presidency. So I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, because I think, we revert to partisanship in the end as opposed to, wait, we do really want to get things solved. So we're kind of our own worst enemy in the end.
Well, this was the case of my details are sketchy, but it would have been the fall before Trump was elected or the summer before Trump was elected when there was that bipartisan immigration bill that had support.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, we don't vote for it, even though it had bipartisan support.
We got a letter about that.
And would have been some compromise. And it's like, well, if you agree on this and pass it, then I lose all of the platforms I was going to be running on.
Well, that was the Democratic position. That was, frankly, nonsense. It wasn't a very good bill. And they said, this is the only way to solve immigration.
It was a very conservative bill. It was backed by the
Republicans. Yeah, no, I was going to say
it was
McCarthy.
A very conservative bill.
McCarthy
was part of it.
Trump fixed it.
Very strong borders.
Trump closed the border in 3 months as an executive. And that's what Biden should have done. And he didn't because he was for open borders.
But this was much more expansive than just closing the borders in terms of how to have a sensible long-term immigration policy, not just close the borders, deport.
But it was the executive branch is capable of doing it, and Trump did it in 3 months. And Biden could have done it, but he really didn't.
Sure. No, you're right. That was a conscious policy choice on both sides.
That was Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, June 27th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.